Let's take a trip back in time and go with West Michigan historian Larry B. Massey. His new book is called Blue Water, Red Metal, and Green Gold, The Color of Michigan's Past. Larry, it is good to have you back with us again.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Cynthia.
This is the 12th book now of your series, Voyages into Michigan's Past. What are you focusing on for this book, Larry?
It's a variety of different things. There's 27 different articles, starting in a story that took place in 1811, running all the way up into the 1950s. Just colorful, human interest type stories that I'm hoping other people want to read about.
All right, so let's get a sampling of some of these stories you've uncovered, and then I want to talk more about how and where you do your research, because the details in these stories are so rich. But let's start with the chapter you call Blue Water Graveyard. Tell us about the schooner Augusta and the steamer Lady Elgin. This was, what, 1860?
Right, September 1860. Lady Elgin was a palatial sidewheel steamer, about 250 feet long, and it was running from Chicago to Milwaukee, taking back a bunch of excursionists. The Augusta was a sailing vessel, a schooner, that was carrying lumber. And it had left Port Huron about 8 days before, had to go up through the straits, and then was heading down to Chicago. Well, a storm came about, a bad one, and Augusta rammed the Lady Elgin with a long pole in the front of it. It's called a jib boom. And it didn't realize it had done that much damage. The ships broke apart away from each other, and the Augusta continued on its way. The Lady Elgin, as it turned out, had been given its death blow. Mm. The wound was below the water, and it sank in about 20 minutes' time. And as it sank, there was an explosion, blew most of it apart. Some of the people aboard, about 500 people aboard, were able to cling to wreckage. But then the storm was so bad that it tore the wreckage apart, and a few of them made it to shore. But then there was another big problem because of the waves beating against the shore and amidst the wreckage. It's estimated that 287 to 350 people perished that terrible night. It's one of the worst marine disasters on the Great Lakes. Probably the only one that was worse than that was a steamship that rolled over in the harbor at Chicago called the Eastland. And, of course, both the captains were from Michigan. Captain Jack Wilson aboard the Lady Elgin was from Coldwater. And Captain Darius Malott was from Port Huron. That's where it had taken off with a load of lumber.
And they were longtime Great Lakes veterans, weren't they?
They were. They didn't know each other, except for that one time when they met. Disastrous. Mm. You know, it was also kind of strange that 4 years later, exact day, 4 years later, September 1864, Captain Malott was in charge of another vessel called the Mojave, and it mysteriously disappeared out on Lake Michigan and was never seen again.
Okay, good story, Blue Water Graveyard. You have a chapter called Red Metal Bonanza, Larry, that really gives us quite a view of copper country in the Keweenaw Peninsula from a guy named Robert Clark. Who was he and what brought him to copper country in 1852?
He was a journalist from out east. He wrote articles for Harper's Monthly and other periodicals. And he came there in the summer of 1852 just to check out all this excitement over the copper. And he went to the Cliff Mine, which is near Eagle River, and that was one of the most profitable mines that they ever found in the Upper Peninsula. Huge masses of native copper. I mean, some of them weighing tons and tons. So big that they couldn't move them. They had to chisel them apart laboriously. Most of these miners were from Cornwall, where they were experienced in mining. And he went up there and described it, and just beautiful prose and illustrations. And so that gave me an idea about writing about that copper country, which, you know, people had known about the copper up there for generations, but it took promotional efforts of Douglas Houghton, who was a state geologist, to really start this copper rush in the 1840s that rivaled the later California gold rush.
You have a whole chapter about a traveler from New York who came to Michigan Territory and decided not to buy into the popular belief that Michigan was a place where basically you will get sick, which we think was probably pushed by the folks in Ohio, wasn't it?
Well, some people think so. The Surveyor General from Ohio promoted that idea that Michigan was nothing but a gigantic swamp full of wild animals and snakes and mosquitoes that bit you and gave you a disease they called the ague, which really was malaria. They didn't know it back then.
But there was this guy named, is it Elkanah
oh, yeah.
Watson?
Yes, Yes.
What did he find when he came to Michigan?
He found that Michigan was beautiful and wonderful and stood to become one of the finest states in the Union. And he was way ahead of his time when he was writing that, because in 1818, when he came, there was hardly any people here in Michigan. Yeah. But he saw the potential. And I found that several other travelers who came to Michigan noticed that Michigan had this wonderful potential, and they figured it won't be long before it takes off. And they were right.
A lot of people might not remember or realized even that during World War II, German prisoners were held in a POW camp in the Allegan State Forest. So you took that but dug way, way back to describe how that area came to be a state forest. And what a story with lumberjacks and lumber barons and shifty real estate swindlers.
Oh, yeah. When people first came into this area, Allegan County, western Allegan County in the 1830s, they found this beautiful pine forest. I'm talking about white pine trees that were 150 to 200 feet tall. Three men together couldn't get their arms around some of those big trees. And they were worth a fortune. When the lumberjacks came in and began hewing them down, they called them green gold because they were worth a fortune. Well, they hewed them all right, particularly after 1871 when Chicago went up in flames. There was a call for send us all the Michigan white pine you can. And within 4 years' time, they'd cut down all that pine that was anywhere near the Kalamazoo River Valley. And so there it was. There was a town established at the mouth of the Kalamazoo River called Singapore, and there were lumber mills there. And when there was no more lumber to come down the river, they just up and moved it. And that left Singapore without any jobs, and so people just moved away, and now it lies under the sand dunes at the mouth of the river.
Boy.
Well, the township where most of this land was originally called Pine Plains. And anybody that knew anything about farming knew that that would not be good soil. Pine trees go on sandy, kind of worthless soil. Well, by the turn of the century, the late 1890s, some get-rich-quick real estate developers decided that they would get the name changed to Valley, Valley Township. That denotes this beautiful agricultural area. And they were able to buy up these large tracts of what was worthless land for just pennies on the acre. And then they platted them into 10-acre sites. And at the same time, there was a back-to-nature movement going on in the cities. People wanted to get out of the city and have a small farm somewhere. And so it was ripe for them to buy into this Valley Township farmlands. Well, there was a layer of mulch over the sand, and they could farm that for 10, 15 years. But by the late 1920s, they were starving to death. Actually starving to death, some of them. Some of them just moved away and left their land to back taxes. But then in the 1930s, one of the New Deal programs was a resettlement program for people living on poor farmland. The government would either buy it from them or else they'd trade them land elsewhere. And so the government began buying up the land that became the Allegan State Forest. Eventually, they had 50,000 acres they bought up. A group of these people from the area were sent up to the Matanuska Valley in Alaska, where they grow those strawberries as big as your fist, to homestead up there. Eventually, that was what the Allegan State Forest came from, and now the pine trees have returned, and it's what it should have been. It's a beautiful forest, not farmland.
It is a story that has a lot of sad chapters, but it ends happily.
It does end happily, because now we can enjoy this beautiful 50,000-acre tract of trees.
We're speaking with West Michigan historian Larry B. Massey as we talk about his latest book, his 21st book. It's called Blue Water, Red Metal, and Green Gold, The Color of Michigan's Past. I want to roll the clock ahead a century or so, Larry, to World War II.
Uh-huh.
Tell us why so many wounded soldiers, sailors, and Marines wound up in Battle Creek.
Well, there was a place there called the Battle Creek Sanitarium. John Harvey Kellogg was the proprietor of that. And it was like a world-famous health spa, and it was a big fieldstone building. Well, it went bankrupt in the 1920s, as many places did, and the federal government acquired it and turned it into a hospital that specialized in taking care of people that were amputees during the war. Percy Jones General Hospital, it was called. And I was very interested to find out that Bob Dole, Senator Bob Dole, wrote an autobiography, and he devoted several chapters to his experiences while he was recuperating from his wounds he received in World War II. At the same time, Daniel Inouye from Hawaii, who later became a senator, and Senator Phil Hart from Michigan were there, and they became friends, even though they were rivals politically.
All of that born is they recovered at Percy Jones General Hospital.
Right.
And you have to give us a sense of the tale of two brothers from Kalamazoo who are just incredible representatives of the greatest generation.
Yes, they were. Don and Andy Seeley grew up in Kalamazoo, and they were a very, very poor family. Their mother had been divorced, and they just were just hardly getting by. But they were both pretty good athletes. Well, Don, after he graduated from high school, joined the Marines, and Andy joined the Army. Don was involved at Iwo Jima, trying to go up that terrible hill there. And while he was doing that, a Japanese sniper shot his eye out. It should have killed him, but the bullet didn't go directly into his brain. It came out obliquely, so he survived with one eye. Within weeks after that, Andy Seeley, who was in Italy, stepped on a mine and it blew his leg off. He survived also. These two veterans returned back to Kalamazoo. Don got into selling cars and made a fortune. And he used that patch that he wore on his eye as kind of a way to prove himself different from a lot of car salesmen. And, you know, he treated everybody right, and when a customer came back in, they wanted that guy with the patch, even though they couldn't remember his name. And that was one of the keys to his success. Andy recovered, and even though he had an artificial leg, he became sheriff of Cass County. And both of these guys really led very successful lives despite the problems that they'd incurred during World War II.
Larry, what does it take to dig up so much detail for these 27 stories?
Well, you know, some of it is serendipity. When I'm researching something, I come across an interesting fact and I salt it away. And then maybe a year later, I'll find something related to that. And finally, I've got enough to tell a story. And like I say, it's serendipity, a lot of the research. I was at an estate sale a few years ago, and the person who had died had evidently been interested in buying a travel trailer in the early 1950s. And he had a pile of these brochures from different travel trailer companies, and I bought them, okay? And then when I got them home, I was looking at this one, and it was from the New Moon Trailer Company of Alma, Michigan. And they were promoting the fact that Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz had made a movie called The Long, Long Trailer in 1954. Some of your listeners may know about that movie. But they had used this New Moon trailer, and they were promoting the fact that the company was that they had been picked from all the trailer companies. And that gave me an idea about writing about that, and it gave me an opportunity to get Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz into my book as well. And I found out that, you know, in the 1950s, Michigan was the leading manufacturers of mobile homes and travel trailers.
Your source material comes from many, many places, it's clear.
Oh, it does.
The book is Blue Water, Red Metal and Green Gold, The Color of Michigan's Past, written by my guest, Larry B. Massey. It's always good to talk with you. Thank you very much, Larry.
Thank you, Cynthia.